This is an ABC podcast.
Before we start this episode of the Pop Test, just a quick warning that this episode is about reproduction.
So it gets a little frisky.
Might not be appropriate for small children.
Testing. 1, 2, 3.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Pop Test, a quiz about science. I'm Andy Matthews, the glue in the pot of glue that is this hosting team.
And I am the different glue the company uses to stick the label on that pot, a flagrant display of disrespect right under the nose of the other glue. Assuming glue does have a nose, which, now that I think of it, seems like a risky thing to give to something that releases glue fumes. Alistair Tremblay-Burchell. And today's episode is about reproduction. Andy, what is reproduction?
Alistair, I knew I was going to have this conversation with you eventually.
Right, well, I can tell from the re at the beginning of the word that it's probably regarding something, but what could it be?
Simply put, reproduction is copying, and I assume that's why it's not allowed during university exams. In a practical sense, it's the process that has allowed life to continue since the first single-celled organism got a bit frisky.
But what's scandalous is that so much of this reproducing must have occurred before marriage, which has probably only been around for about 4,000 years.
Mm. And obviously it's awkward to talk about your parents or grandparents having sex, so fingers crossed it's not exponentially more awkward to talk about your distant ancestors doing it.
And speaking of it is time to introduce our guests. Our first guest is journalist and broadcaster Beverly Wang. Beverly, reproduction, good or bad?
I'm going to speak for humans, and I'm going to say reproduction is generally good, but the manner in which reproduction takes place, as in the delivery of the human, and I say this as someone who has done it, not so good.
Yeah, you think maybe we need like an external pot or something like that to grow the baby.
Can we outsource this process in some way?
Feels like something that could be done in a crock pot.
It's very time consuming. It asks a lot of us.
Yeah.
And it affects pay equality, which is really nonsense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we'll get into pay equality as it applies to the different kingdoms
Real
of life,
world
but
issues.
You know, we'll see how that comes up. And our second guest is a reproductive biologist at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Marissa Parrott. Marissa, reproduction. Do you think it still has a place in today's society?
Absolutely.
Okay, good to know.
We need this reproduction not only for our societies, but working at Zoos Victoria, also for our amazing endangered species, many of which reproduce in a much more clever way than we do.
Which species reproduces in the most clever way, would you say?
I think our marsupials, our beautiful native Australian marsupials, have the best reproduction. A human that's going to give birth to a baby will be pregnant for 9 months,
yes,
much of which is really uncomfortable. A marsupial, like the endangered eastern barred bandicoot, is pregnant for a total of 12.5 days. So they are just so much more clever than we are.
I bet they have much better pay equality than us as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
And our final guest is comedian Lloyd Langford. Lloyd, in your ideal scenario, how would reproduction work?
I'm a man, and so I have it pretty peachy as it stands.
So you're happy with the status quo?
Yeah.
In fairness, what should actually happen is that halfway through the pregnancy, the baby should be somehow transferred to the father. Mm-hmm. Sort of like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly. You need to teleport the baby into the father so he can do the remaining 4.5 months. And obviously you hope that like a fly doesn't get mixed up with the DNA.
And remember, like the multiple heads of a male echidna's genitalia, you are all on the same team, Team Science, working together to defeat the forces of ignorance. Reproduction, as we all know, is a disgusting and embarrassing act that occurs trillions of times every day. So let's take a walk of shame through time to the very birth of birth itself in this, the History Round.
The earliest common ancestor of all things alive today was a single-celled organism that managed to split in two and then get into the clone zone. One became two, and the rest is quite literally history. This kind of binary fission is how the majority of living things still reproduce today. Bacteria, archaea, amoeba, a single living cell or an organelle grows to twice its size and then splits into two identical daughter cells. But Beverly.
Yes.
Why is it bad to eat three-day-old poo?
I'm so, so glad that you asked me this question. And I don't know what's wrong with you, but obviously the connection between reproduction and three-day-old poo is very obvious. It's a straight line.
Clear. We try to make things as clear as possible.
I think that it's bad to eat three-day-old poo because only the plebs eat three-day-old poo.
Sure.
Only the proles, you know, the people who get written about in broadsheet newspapers about having dirty homes and smoking too many cigarettes.
Mm.
Those people eat the three-day-old poo. Us.
Yeah.
We don't do that kind of, the 1% in this podcast, we don't do that. It's, we all know actually that eating fresh poo is the most delicious poo.
I mean, fresh is best is kind of close to being the answer here. The reason it's bad to eat three-day-old poo is because of how fast and efficient binary fission is. E. coli is a bacteria common in the intestine, where their numbers are kept under control. But unchecked, they can split every 20 minutes, meaning that after 8 hours, one bacterium can turn into 17 million bacteria. In feces, this exponential growth means they reach a maximum population after about 3 days, making this the worst in a crowded field of bad times to eat it.
Reproduction is ultimately a way to pass on genetic material, but building an entirely new organism just to pass on a couple of DNA molecules can seem inefficient, like making a child just so that you've got somewhere to put your hat. So, Marissa, in what way are bacteria like Keanu Reeves in the movie The Matrix?
I think it's probably a matter of perspective. Mm. So, Neo, which is Keanu Reeves' character, in some ways, from some people, is seen as a hero and really good.
Yes.
But from the system, in other ways, he's seen as disruptive and bad and destroying the system. And I think it was maybe Hugo Weaving's character who said, humans are like a disease. Bacteria, probably a similar thing. On one side, they're really good. We need them to survive. Mm-hmm. Things like our important bacteria in our stomachs. On the other side, some bacteria cause major diseases like anthrax and tuberculosis and botulism. Now, botulism, matter of perspective again. So you have this toxin produced by bacteria that can either cause major disease, botulism, or be used in Botox, which brings us back to Hollywood and back to The Matrix.
And the fact that Keanu Reeves never seems to age.
He doesn't.
That's a very good answer. I'm going to give you the points.
Thank you. Ours
is slightly different. We say that much like Neo getting the knowledge of Kung Fu through a spike in his head socket, bacteria can learn new skills by downloading information from other bacteria in a process called conjugation. One donor bacterium uses a microscopic tube-like protuberance called a pilus to insert a strand of new DNA into a recipient bacterium. If the donor has evolved a new trait like antibiotic resistance, this can be transferred to the recipient and spread through the species, or even across distantly related bacterial species. Also like Neo, bacteria find themselves at home in a nerd's trench coat.
I was going to say that they keep coming back even though you wish they wouldn't.
Recently, a new strain has emerged.
The first evidence of sexual reproduction comes from microscopic algae preserved in rocks in Canada, where distinct male and female spores can be found that are over 1 billion years old. But Lloyd, what is the twofold cost of sex?
I've never actually paid for sex, apart from obviously emotionally.
But, right. Sure. Well, okay, so that's one cost.
Yeah.
If we can get one more, we could be getting close.
Hopefully, if it's taxing on your partner, then that could be the twofold cost.
Too fast, and it could be a sort of friction.
Okay. So one is the emotional cost, and the other one, obviously, is rubbing.
Yeah, well, that would be an energy cost as well.
Sure. You know? Yeah, okay.
Is this something to do with the results of sex? Obviously, the child will inherit the faults of both parents.
You are actually correct that it does have to do with getting the genetic material from both your parents. Well, the cost of sex is twofold because sexual reproduction takes half the chromosomes of one parent and half the chromosomes of the other parent. So only 50% of the genetic material is passed on each time.
while still requiring just as much energy to reproduce as asexual reproduction. This apparent significant downside has led to a debate about how sex evolved in the first place.
But the first evidence of animals reproducing sexually actually comes from closer to home. So, Beverly, how can you tell something was having sex 565 million years ago in South Australia?
565 million year old cigarette butts.
Littered around.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And half empty wine bottles and the like.
Probably in the Barossa.
Yes, of course. Sure. Yeah.
And the Rundle Mall balls, do they factor into this in any way?
The Rundle Mall balls came afterward, but they were a great enhancement.
Sure. Yeah. I'll see if you're correct. The correct answer is, well, you're actually very close. So it's not directly, but we learn about it from fossilized evidence of this taking place. And the answer is from the layout of fossils of a tube-like animal called Funisia. Specimens of this animal, all the same age, are found clustered together. This is evidence of a form of reproduction where spores are released, fertilized, and form larval spat falls, settling and growing together.
Of course. Yeah. That was going to be my second answer.
You know, cigarettes are also tubular-like, so I'll give you another point
Thank
for that
so
as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
But Marissa, what can you assume about a fish that has arms and a bit of Velcro?
I'm thinking that little fish is up to no good.
Yeah.
And I would like to be its friend. Arms on a fish. Now, it's a really interesting one. There are some fish that have appendages that have turned into something like arms.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got super cute little hand fish, which are small, brightly coloured, have an adorably grumpy look on their face. But their little fins have actually evolved into something like arms and even fingers that they use to walk along the ocean ground. Now, many of them are endangered, like the spotted hand fish. So maybe they use Velcro to try and catch their little lots of food so they're not endangered anymore. If you look at it a different way, though, like bearing arms, we have overfished. There's a lot of pollution. Most fish don't have hands like the hand fish. Mm. So maybe they could Velcro tiny little torpedoes to themselves and fight back. And I would pay to see that.
This is a great way to address the overfishing of the oceans.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the fish that fish back.
I'm going to give you a point for that.
Thank you.
But the answer that we have is the primitive fish Microbrachius dicky lived 385 million years ago. Fossils indicate that it had two little arms, and what's more, the male and female versions had different attachments that interlocked like Velcro, allowing them to hold each other for sexual reproduction, making this not only the earliest fossil evidence of internal fertilization, but also the first recorded cuddle.
Mm.
Internal fertilization is less wasteful than the spawning system still used by most fish today.
And Lloyd, what is the world's most indecisive lizard?
I know that there's a monitor lizard, so is there a not sure what to monitor lizard?
Yeah, sure. Or the should I stay or should I go, Anna?
I think it could possibly be a chameleon because they're constantly changing colour.
Mm.
Like someone that's decided to paint the spare room and then had second thoughts. The chameleon was one of the animals that God made first, not realizing how many he had to create. He put a lot of effort into that. I reckon he was messing around with a chameleon for about 5 days.
Yeah.
And then he was like, I've got 2 days left now. Let's have some moths.
Put all of my best ideas in this chameleon. All right, let's just make some worms, largest tubes.
I'm afraid the correct answer is the Australian three-toed skink, of course, which lays both eggs and produces live births. Across the animal kingdom, live birth has evolved many times, including 115 times in reptiles alone. In 2019, Australian scientists found one three-toed skink producing both eggs and live young from the same pregnancy, and they believe they can switch modes depending on the situation. This suggests that live birth may evolve in response to environmental variability. From fossil evidence, we know that today's live-bearing mammals had a common ancestor 160 million years ago.
Which brings us to the end of round one. And Team Science, you were on 7 points, which means you're still in this.
Yes.
RN, the pop test.
And now on to round two. Now, we don't pretend to have all the answers, but we are happy to pretend that our guests do by asking them to give us their best guess, and then we will correct them because we have all the answers. This round is called How Do Whales Work? So, Beverly.
Yes.
What do you reckon happens during sexual reproduction?
I'm feeling like this is kind of a personal question, Andy. I don't know why I'm getting all of these. I think I might actually know this one.
Hit us.
Fertilization of, Right. Well, in the human case, the egg and the sperm. I'm getting like really hot now. Everybody's staring at me.
I'm getting really hot as well. Keep talking.
It's sexy. Sexual reproduction is so sexy.
It's real flashbacks to sex ed at school,
hot.
Isn't it?
And then I think a lot of cells, they do a lot of splitting up. And then eventually you get your reproductee.
Yes. That's also what I call my children. Yes. All right, reproductees, into the car.
That's right.
Well, I'm going to give you partial points. Yes, we start with the DNA that makes up the genes of an organism and is organized into chromosomes. The chromosomes, which come in pairs, separate, and the cell splits into gametes. For example, as you so rightly point out, sperm and egg, which have half the genetic information of the original cell. This can even happen in single-celled organisms like yeast that turn their whole body back into gametes. Then, two organisms have to find a way to get their gametes together to make a fertilized zygote. This could rely on chance, like the broadcast spawning of fish, or be more clinical, using bees or other creatures, the online dating of the offline world.
It is very sexy when you put it that way.
Yeah.
It's hot.
It's actually gotten much colder in the room since Eddie mentioned that. Now, Marissa, what, in your opinion, is the benefit of sexual reproduction?
The benefit is taking the genes from two compatible parents and mixing them to create a healthy offspring that is adaptable for the future and continues your genetic line.
Reproductee is the technique.
Reproductee. Creating that reproductee that's adaptable for the future. But again, there are animals out there that do it a lot better than humans. And one of those is one of my favourites, the critically endangered mountain pygmy possum that I work with up at Healesville Sanctuary. And they actually hedge their bets for the future because the female can produce a litter of young with more than one father.
Wow.
She will mate with more than one male in her estrus period, give birth to up to four young, and half of those might come from father A and half from father B. And so depending on what happens in future years, some of those babies may be doing better than others, and she can sort of hedge her bets on that.
You are absolutely right. As we discussed, there are costs to reproducing sexually because you only get to pass on half your genes. So there have to be significant benefits to make it worthwhile. And while there's still big debate about this, there are probably a few factors involved. Yeast, as we mentioned, only reproduces sexually under environmental stress, and it seems that sharing DNA gives the population an opportunity to share knowledge that might help cope with a changing environment. Also, because we get two different versions of the same chromosome, if a damaging mutation occurs in one, the backup can be used to compensate. When one of the organisms also has to carry the cost of bearing the young, the additional benefits of selecting partners from a competitive field can still make it worthwhile.
Mm. And Lloyd, if you were a fern, how would you approach making love to another fern?
I actually have a friend called Fern who is bisexual, so I could try and get her on the line.
That's a nice way to do it, actually.
I'm having to try and recall now the dim memories of high school biology and the reproductive elements of a plant.
Well, I mean, I can tell you right now, you've already got partial points for mentioning the word bisexual.
Ah, you'd really want to check out the fronds on the other fern.
And, well, you don't want to get frond zoned, though, do you?
I seem to recall plant reproduction, or as I like to call it, tree banging. It's all a bit sort of up in the air, isn't it? They release their pollens or whatnot, or they get transported by insects or the wind. And then they kind of meet the reciprocal parts on the other plant, or they drop the seeds.
There's a lot of good stuff in there. There's a lot of good stuff in the mix there, Lloyd.
The answer that we have is ferns, like mosses, have an interesting reproduction strategy called alternation of generations, where every second generation has a different form. As an adult fern, you don't have genitals. So to reproduce sexually, you shed off a little spore that grows into a tiny fern kid with one leaf that is basically all genitals, called a prothallus. That offspring then waits for rain and squirts sperm and eggs into the water and hopes its sperm will meet another egg and make a new adult. And at the end of that round, Team Science is on 17 points, which means you can still win!
That's extraordinary. Yes.
And this is the Pop Test on ABC Radio National.
And if you want more science comedy quiz, you can hear a whole bunch more on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Finally, it's time for a speed round to take us to the end of the show, but because it's taking us in a particular direction, we call it a velocity round.
Question one, why does the male seahorse wind up carrying the babies?
Marissa.
Seahorses are really cool little animals. They're one of the only fish that's actually monogamous. They don't go off with other fish, and they pair for life. And so it makes really good sense that the female puts a lot of energy into her eggs and having a whole lot of eggs that she then transfers to her partner. And he does almost the pregnancy sort of thing where he raises all of those eggs. And while he's doing that, she's producing more eggs so that they can just keep having clutch after clutch of baby seahorses. Wow. This makes sense because it's a really tough environment for baby seahorses out there. You might get taken away on currents. It's hard to find food. You end up as food for other creatures. Sure. So if he can be helping produce those young, they can get as many out as possible. How did I go?
Really good. Yeah. You're getting the point. You're getting the point. Because once again, the men are the only ones who get pockets, right? And so while we don't know how it arose, we don't know how it arose in an evolutionary sense, we do know that the female deposits her eggs in the male's pouch where they are fertilized.
Question two, what is parasexuality? Lloyd.
Parasexuality, that is sex with your skydiving instructor. It's when you're yanking on something other than the cord.
That sounds good until, you know, you get into the bedroom and they insist on climbing up on top of the cupboard and leaping onto you. You're close. Any process that forms an offspring from more than one parent, but that bypasses standard sexual forms. It includes conjugation in bacteria, weird fungi, where two sets of DNA wind up in the one cell, and mutant viruses that occur when two viruses infect and multiply in the same cell simultaneously.
What is the downside to having an attractive voice?
Lloyd, yes, I knew you'd answer this.
The perfect person to answer this.
Yes, I'd like to say so far I have found that there are no downsides.
That is incorrect, unfortunately. For men, the downside is lower semen quality. Studies have found that biologically, men with more attractive voices have lower sperm concentrations. It's an example of a trade-off where bodies have to choose how to expend their resources. Spending on developing a larger voice box seems to mean that you have less to spend growing sperm. Obviously, a very deep-sounding single sperm.
Sure.
Here it comes.
How do sperm swim? Marissa?
So it was always thought that sperm swam by shaking their little tail, sort of like a tadpole. But more recently, they found out that sperm can actually only shake their tail one direction. And so they've had to come up with this really interesting way of spinning. So it's not so much that sperm swim, it's that they kind of corkscrew through fluid to try and get up to find an egg.
You are exactly right. Yes, they don't swim, they drill. 3D microscopy has revealed sperm spiral through fluid more like a corkscrew.
Wow.
That, I mean, that was a word perfect answer.
Yeah. I didn't need to say it.
Give her more points.
Yeah, double points, please.
5 points for you.
Five. Excellent.
And some points to Lloyd for saying it in such a beautiful voice.
Which brings us to the end of the show. And Team Science, you are on 30 points, which means you win!
Yay!
Congratulations! Yay!
Thanks to our guests, biologist Marissa Parrott, journalist Beverly Wang, and comedian Lloyd Langford.
Thank you for listening, and until next time, a personal announcement.
I am pleased to tell you that I lost my last baby tooth this morning. I also lost a baby leg and a baby arm. I misplaced a baby. I'm in a lot of trouble. Goodbye.
See ya.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.